This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by J-Food-O, dedicated to sharing the best Japan has to offer. Over the next few months, J-Food-O and a selection of London restaurants will create seafood and sake pairings for spectator listeners to help develop your knowledge and enjoyment of the drink. The pairing will focus on the concept of umami, which in Japanese means the essence of deliciousness.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Michael Heath. Michael is a cartoonist and illustrator. His first cartoon in The Spectator was published in 1957. His first cover illustration first appeared in 1964. And he has been cartoon editor since 1991. His work has appeared in numerous British publications, including Punch, The Evening Standard, The Guardian, The Sunday Times, The Mail on Sunday, and Private Eye. All his work is simply signed as Heath. Michael, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you very much. It stops me drawing. otherwise, I'd be at night and day.
Michael, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Do you know, I can't remember a thing about it. The rationing was on. So it was about 1935, so I mean, the war started soon after. What I remember about sweets is that when the Americans came over here in 1944, they threw all their sweets at us because they had loads of stuff given to them in little packages every day, all the food they wanted, even fried eggs, for God's sake. It's difficult to believe. But they threw chewing gum at us and all that. Chewing gum was a difficult thing to get hold of. Old men used to come up and offer you a stick of gum and then try to do things to you. So you soon learnt to say, no, thank you very much. I don't like chewing gum. Sweets, no. I don't remember much of that at all, really.
And what about at home? With your parents, who did the cooking at home?
Oh, God almighty. Well, I suppose absolutely my mother. I mean, the thing is, you didn't do anything but that. There was this rule about getting up, going out, and coming out to lunch or whatever, or it was very controlled. He's having tea now and or whatever. Supper didn't seem to come into it, and certainly drink didn't. But no, we all ate together and tried to ignore the bombs going off in Hampstead, which I was in.
Mm. And what about mealtimes? What were they like?
Well, I mean, just in my time, silent. I mean, it came quite as a surprise to me that people talked to each other while they were eating or anything like that. So it wasn't, it just grab it and have it. And we'd lift off porridge and various bits and pieces of stuff and bread. No sweets, of course, hence I've got dentures now. That is a joke, but not a very good one. But I mean, the thing is that sweets we didn't have, and as I say, except chewing gum from American soldiers or whatever. Sweets were rationed anyway in those days, so you couldn't have more than 2 ounces of fruit gums or whatever it is. You had to do without it. Hence, all my teeth fell out. Dentistry wasn't really invented then. I mean, a few people did it and all the rest of it and didn't have the complex things done to their teeth that they can do to you now, replace them and all the rest of it and screw it. So if you look, we were well known for our bad teeth. Mm. The dentists who used to come to the occasional schools I went to would come. We'd all leave by the back door. Nobody wanted to have their teeth scraped or anything like that. So we grew up with dodgy teeth.
And you mentioned school food, or school rather. What was school food like?
I don't remember. Certainly the places I went to in various schools, starting in Devon in 1939 or something, I was sent to various schools around there, but not because of they were going to teach me anything. They just sat and read books or something and gave us comics to read, and that's all. Nobody tried to teach us to spell or write. We made our own amusement somehow or other, and we every now and then someone would do something naughty, and the teacher, who an old man always, because all the young men had gone to the war. So I did then what I do now. I mean, I used my initiative and ran around all over the place and looked for this and looked for that and tried to amuse people, I suppose. But, I mean, I do not remember it. In all the three places I was in, except the last place, I suppose, was Hoban. being bombed. I mean, I was bombed in 1939, cannon fired too on the beach, and we had to get through the barbed wire to get to the shore. And I wasn't frightened of all this. I remember sitting on the beach anyway and looking out at sea. There were two aeroplanes coming towards us. It was a place called Torcross, and there were two other, this was landmines all over the place, and we just sat there because it was a lovely hot day, or I did, I was the only one there, apart from two soldiers, and they said, oh, look, they're ours, meaning they weren't German. And they weren't, they were German, and they split up and cannon fired us all, and dropped a mine on one of the houses and blew one of the old ladies out through the window. And set the water business up, and we again got on with it then. I mean, did go to the school later in the day, and everyone was just talking about that. I mean, fear didn't come into it. I'm used to see a lot of people crying and things like that. My mother, perhaps, more than my father, obviously, but fear wasn't one of the things. It was rather a thrill. And again, when we went to Hampstead and lived there, flat. Hampstead in those days was a charming area and with cheap, affordable flats and houses. And my father, who drew for comics, a comic called Radio Fun and another one called Film Fun, he hated the job and it was working very hard and all the rest of it. And what I'm doing exactly now, actually, because I thought I'd never be like him, because he was stuck with comics and boys stories and things like that. He hated it, even though, but he became a guard at night. He'd have to stay up half the night or most of the night, keeping an eye on what's going or coming across from Germany and coming to bomb us. You could see the centre of London by the flames and things like that. And we all thought, I think, we'd go out in the morning and look for shrapnel and collect that. And then there was a thing they used to do to. That's why I'm trying to avoid that word. But the thing is that they taught them how to deal with incendiary bombs. And you had to go into a little brick building. And they sent these incendiary bombs off. And you had to put them out. Well, all incendiary bombs were tricks. I mean, there were different things. And they all went for a different reason. They blew up for another reason. If you put water on them, they blew up. And if you went to the wrong end of it with a water hose, that went wrong too and exploded in front of you, and that was very difficult. However, I got the hang of that, and my father asked me to take them down to a pub in Hampstead, and there's Spaniards Inn, I said. And I carried them down like milk bottles. So, it's rather thrilling. I had a friend or two like that. We all did it, and we all went down to this pub's basement and piled them up. And I remember going down there and an old lady saw me and fainted because I was, I said, what's wrong with her? She's terrified. I was going to drop one and blow us all up.
Well, I suppose that's fair enough.
Yeah. Then there was the collection of shrapnel, which is terribly exciting. And you'd get a bit of shrapnel written on it as, Berlin, 1941 or something like that. You collect all that and swap it. But no toys.
Tell us about when you left home to pursue your career. What were you eating at that time in your life? Were you a dazzling cook or living hand to mouth?
I don't know. I was living in another house by then in Brighton. Brighton then was the most fantastic place on earth. Everybody that was let out of the army and all the rest of it, were all resting there, and it was full of all Americans and English and Canadians and all the rest of it. And they used to get uproariously drunk all the time because they were bored stiff and often broke into hotels and unscrewed all the bath equipment and threw it off the roof. But I thought it terribly thrilling, and I got a friend whose father ran a pub. So I often helped out in the pub a bit, carrying stuff. And in another place called the Burlesque Club, which was a club for, as it says, naughty people, and I got money there for working in the billiard hall that they had, and I'd be given a shilling to go out to get packed sandwiches. There, I just met all these people. I came across things I'd never even dreamed of before. And the sort of people that were in these afternoon drinking clubs, and in the evening, of course, but I wasn't there in the evening. And I met, you know, and that was introduced all sorts of peculiar women, all prostitutes, very sweet to me. And one of them said to me, the way you're talking, you're going to get yourself into trouble one day, darling. Would you go out and get me this record, a 78, of course, I said. And I went and got this record, and it's called It's My Mother's Birthday Today. I'm on my way with a lovely bouquet. And through that and all the people I'd met, music hall people, there was a place called the Hippodrome around the corner, which was a big music hall. And I used to go in there, and music hall in those days was the acts came on, did their 10 minutes, and then came off, and then another one would come off. Everyone was in hysterics and having great fun, and it seemed terrific. Max Miller was the funniest man on earth, and he had a way of suggesting things going on sexually and all the rest of it. Hello, darling, you know, and all that. And he wasn't Cockney, he was, I don't know what he was, but anyway, he was fascinating. I thought he was terrific, and through him and various other strange people, I found out lots of strange things, criminals, for instance, and women working. And I knew two girls who were identical, who lived with one man, and that seemed to suit them and suited him. People on the run from the police and were hiding in various places, so they didn't want to be arrested. And again, I thought that was fun, and some of the guys over there, again, criminal, would be on the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary. We're talking about 1945, I think, 46. And they'd work as stewards. And they'd go to America and buy clothes, which we couldn't get here. You couldn't get fancy anything. Everything was boring. Clothes were boring. You couldn't get, like, coloured socks or anything. And they'd come back with second-hand American gear, which we went mental for. And, you'd exchange anything you had for it. And I remember giving them an encyclopedia or something for a pair of socks or something to colour it. And there was an excitement of getting something you didn't have. And it was, to say it was fun would not be an exaggeration, but remember, I'm only 12 years old, right? But I met a lot of people, which I was going to meet later on, similar people in London, in Soho. And I then, by then, was old enough to be drunk get on very well with famous drunk people who were fascinating.
Well, Michael, tell us about that time, because obviously you're known as one of the kind of key characters from that Soho crowd, along with Geoffrey Bernard and
yes,
various others like that. What was it like in kind of that period of your life? Was it a very heavy kind of drinking culture?
Oh, yes, of course. Often a glass of wine went down. Everyone was paralytic. And there were people who ran it. I mean, it made Soho what it was. Francis Bacon and Geoffrey Bernard. Francis Bacon pretended to be drunk often, but he got other people drunk and pretended to be drinking champagne that he'd bought. No one was allowed to buy him a drink. And everyone was tanked. And Geoffrey drank morning, noon and night. And I sort of managed to get jokes done and draw for Punch magazine and things like that. You'd be surprised that at the time there was a Sunday paper called the Woman's Sunday Mirror, which taught women to cook and various things. And I did a strip for them called Nellie Noel. And they said, make do with those old shoes that they were worn out. You know, you can put paper in them and give me sound advice. And I did that at £10 a time. It was great fun. But Geoffrey, I took to enormously, and he was very, very, very dangerous. And he was so rude. I found that a lot of men I've come across who are so rude to women often get on very well with them, or the girls come back for more. If you were going to marry Geoffrey, which several did, it meant that you weren't going anywhere. You weren't going to a theatre, you weren't going to a cinema, and you probably weren't going to a restaurant. You were going to the Coach and Horses or the French in Soho, from morn, noon and night, and breakfast. And they'd have to stand there, and you'd try to warn them, you know, really think you should marry him, you know, because he's a nightmare. And They did. He was original and he was very funny, and I suppose he was scared most of the time, although he'd never admit it. He was horse riding mad. No, he didn't ride horse, he was betting horse. He took bets, which he shouldn't do in a pub. And we ended up in court and they let him off. They were fun, and life was odd and dangerous and strange, and the people were very, very varied, right? Most people have had some sort of education, or they'd been in private school or college or whatever like that. Invariably, they were all gay, and they'd been through terrible things in the war. That many of them had been in, troop ships that had sunk, and they'd somehow survived it and left it. And they were sort of good people to meet, funny and original and all the rest of it. The trouble was, not that I thought it was trouble at the time, you had to drink with them, which is whiskey, and they would line up at the bar at 11 o'clock in the morning, Geoffrey in one corner, coffee girls lung up, and he'd ordered the drinks, and he wouldn't pay for them. The landlord took the money from us, but he would just be amazing. He wouldn't say anything. He'd come up with all these funny things that have happened to him. And he'd be sort of outrageous at the things he got away with and said. And I worked with him on a play he wrote called Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell. I did drawings for it. By that I mean for stage. It was not just a large piece of card, and I did the drawing. Peter O'Toole came on and did his bit. Peter O'Toole was the first one to do Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell, and Peter O'Toole by then was so sober. But up to that point, he'd been drunk like all the others all the time. And Geoffrey was very soppy in some ways, but he liked to be patted on the head and all the rest of it. He was terribly proud about this play, Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell, written by Keith Waterhouse. And every night he'd go into the Wyndham's or whatever it is, or the theatre it was on, and sit by the bar, because he liked to hear people coming to the bar in the middle of the day. And they'd say, oh, it's marvellous. And I thought it was so funny when Geoffrey Bernard was, and he thought that was good, so he thought that. And one day he went in there and sat down, and the doorman had changed. And someone else who looked after him, and the man said, oi, you out, you're no good, you're rubbish, And he said, you know who you're talking to? You asterisk. He said, you're Geoffrey Bernard, aren't you, or something like that. He said, yes. He said, no, you're not. Geoffrey Bernard's up on stage. And so on and so on. And so it went. How I did all the work I did, I really don't know. But I could work well drunk.
Did people eat anything at this time?
Eat?
Yeah, was food a thing?
No. I mean, eating was something you just, is a sideline, a sort of thing that you'd had to do. You've been told it by a doctor, and I said you must get something down that, down your screech, as they call it. I did not belong to the crowd that went with Bernard and eat oysters. He would like that and eat that. But no, food wasn't the main thing in my circle at all, no. It's all a bit of a mystery to me what I did and what I didn't eat. I wouldn't know about that. For a time, I was living in Brighton, so I was on the train at night. I get the 7 o'clock down. And that train had a bar on it. And people were drunk when they got on the train, and they'd been drinking since they got on the train getting up at 7:30, and they were going back to their wives. And it's amazing, miniatures in every pocket.
And during that time, what was your drink of choice? What were you personally drinking?
I drank because they drank whiskey, I drank whiskey. It seemed to be all right, I could handle it, just shouting at people, I suppose, but I don't know. Whiskey seemed to be the drink of choice, unless you drink champagne, which I don't like.
Michael, what about your cartooning? How important is food and drink as a subject for cartoons? I know a lot of your cartoons often have it as a subject.
You've got the wrong guy here. I'm not a gourmet in any way.
No, but it does feature a lot in cartoons.
What you asked me earlier about food. The earliest memory I had of food was going to a fish and chip shop, which then you let them out of newsprint, newspapers and all the rest of it, and that was okay. And I thought that was fine, and it was threepence or something. So that was good. So I suppose I existed on that, and whatever else was thrown at me. I mean, I just do not remember.
Mm. No, but sorry, more as a subject matter, like in your actual cartoons that you draw.
I just look up stuff and the table and manners and all the rest of it, and I look up. And I know the sort of people who are eating them and things like that, and I do that, and I try and get the right knife and fork. So things like that. Yes, but I specialise in drawing people as they look, and the changing of their clothes and all the rest of it, and how they dressed in the old days, and how you could be, you know, in the 50s and all the rest of it. It would be a waistcoat, not that I did that, but I mean, suits. You knew where you were with suits. I even did a strip about suits. It was in Private Eye. It was probably killed by the editor who shot everything I did. So he's not funny, so I left it at that and went off somewhere else. But food was something the middle class did, or upper class. Eating out was very unusual, although I did it occasionally. But I then sort of, I was a bit uneasy, I think, about sitting around people and which is the right knife and fork, and do you eat out of your hands or something, and when do you drink and all that. It was a very, it's quite a business now, because never now and then, most restaurants you go to was shouting or falling over and all the rest of it. So, but in those days, it could be quite an ordeal. You know, you could be kicked out of as being a pariah for using the wrong fork. But that it was never much in my life, that. My chewing gum is more my game, I think. You've got the wrong guy for gourmet. Whiskey takes away your... You don't need to eat with whiskey. You seem to be able to get away with it. Mm. And keep awake. I mean, that's the best one.
And what is comfort food for you, Michael?
Good God. I've been married 3 times. I have no idea. I found myself in many situations, usually alone and looking after myself. I found that sort of okay. But that was pretty awful, really. You know, I just grabbed something in some shop and take it home and cry. I didn't eat properly at all. I drank still then. And I said, I should be dead, I suppose. And maybe I am, and this is a nightmare, but I think it's... No, there was no... I could ask a piece of fish and things like that. You know, count me out. Not for me, I couldn't eat another thing. So as we didn't have it and brought up without it, we didn't get corpulent and we didn't have a craving for food, as you call it, upper middle class eating and things like that. But it didn't come into our lives. It was very secondary. Like toys, we couldn't get those. And clothes, we couldn't get them. So you came up without a lot of... And also, you kept in your... When you were young, I'd say 12 or whatever it is like that and younger, you had to watch what you said to people, because otherwise you get a thick ear. A thick ear, by the way, is when they hit you around the head. But I mean, the thing is that you can't, you couldn't say, you couldn't walk around as you could now as they go around saying, you couldn't do that. Someone would come up and go, bosh, you'd have had it. But if you were lucky, I suppose, you had one pair of trousers, long, one suit, possibly, and a jumper. And I had friends, in the early years, who were stitched into their clothes, and they were about 6 years old, and they were stitched into their clothes at the beginning of winter and didn't come out of them until May. That seems...
Sounds a bit...
It saved a lot of money and all the rest of it. But you had realised that we didn't have any luxuries, as you call them. There wasn't that. And that's why we're all slim and dancing around and all the rest of it. We didn't have chocolate. I said it earlier about the stuff that now makes people fat. They eat chunks of it all the time and never stop. They can talk on the phone and eat at the same time, and usually do. So they don't understand why they end up at 20 stone. But that, I suppose, I didn't realise it would probably save my life. So fasting quite a bit and running around and being chased by policemen, or old men in my cases. I could have made a fortune, but old men following me around and off me sixpence. And take you into the cinema, which you couldn't get in on your own because you were too young. So they sit next to you and start fumbling with your knee, and then you were off. You know, and that was, again, take you for granted, the rest of it. I remember going into the cinema when it was empty, early in the evening, I suppose. I sat down in the corner. I was the only one there at the back. An old man, I say old man, a man came through the door at the bottom where the gents are and walked all the way around and sat next to me and put his knee on. I'm sure you're aware of such things going on even now. And I just said, got up and said something. A friend of mine who was learning to smoke, I say learning, he was smoking, I didn't. and he stubbed his cigarette out on the back of the hand. And the lights went up, and this man's going, ah! that sort of thing, yes.
And Michael, what about now? Your wife, Hilary, is involved with the French House in Soho. Are you still in touch with the scene in Soho? Do you still go to Soho much?
Well, I do. I was there last night, but I don't know anyone there much anymore because they're all dead or mad or shot themselves, so I don't have many people to go there. Conversation is with any pub in Soho is almost impossible. You have to bellow at each other. But I certainly have. My wife works behind the counters, and she knows more than I do. I find them rather boring. You know, what do you do, you know, for a living? You know, I'm a cartoonist. Okay. I just thought Soho to me wasn't eating. I'm looking back at it and looking in magazines and seeing stuff that was being sold and how much it cost. It must have been lovely there because the proper restaurants and proper Italian people and families and cooking and everything. It was heaven on earth. I didn't know about that. And now it's awful. I mean, food is, you know, pretty nightmarish. And you're given about 10 minutes to finish and get out. It's charmless. The people are charmless. The noise is impossible. They only listen to... and they've got that, but they don't. No, they've got their earphones and all the rest of it. But I find the social life is just dire. I mean, just, as far as I'm concerned, it's not because I got all this rubbish in my head, which is coming out now a bit. So you'll have to hold me down because the thing is that the people I knew, intelligent people, who were in some way wrong or got wrong or come right, done life is terrible things to them, but they were all intelligent people invariably, you know, as I said, they all had these a good education and all the rest of it, and perhaps they were army and sergeants and soldiers and it would be impossible, absolutely impossible for Oscar Wilde to live, because Oscar, everything he said is written down, isn't it, still. Never trust a man who runs off with your shoes. I said, it's pretty dreadful, you know, life is, you know, either you're looking up at the stars or down in the gutter. Eh, what? That's all you get. They don't know anything, so they're quite happy. The girls they come up with don't know anything either, so that, they do that for a time. Then, of course, they want children. But after that point, they could all do whatever they want, but they don't want to do anything intellectual, anything that requires effort or skill. I apologise to all of them out there. I'm sure they're full of skill and understanding and deeply wonderful at home, but Oscar would not have taken to it much at all. In fact, he would have, I don't know about his drinking habits, he was pretty strong, I suppose, but mostly champagne, but I don't think he was an alcoholic in that way. But no, there's no way anybody could hear you if you came up with anything witty or anything like that. I'll write that down. Oh, right. Why don't you piss off? Dan Farson, rudest man in the world. He was an alcoholic. He'd been banned from every pub in Cornwall and Devon. And he'd come into the coach, or you'd see him in the morning, and he'd say, he did television programmes. He was an interviewer and very intelligent. He'd say, oh, hello, Michael, lovely to see you. A marvellous drawing I saw the other day of yours in Everybody magazine or something like that. And I'd say, oh, thanks very much, Michael. And you'd see him in the evening, he'd be totally, he said, I loathe you. Everything about me makes you sick. You're rubbish. You can't draw. You can't paint. And a lot of people gave you that. And you had to steal yourself, you know. Francis Bacon would say terrible things to you, you know. Oh, sir, I can't say them now, what he'd say to you. I mean, he was always being introduced to me, and I didn't want to know him because he was a dangerous man and had various dodgy things going on. And I really wouldn't go into it, but things with his paintings and all the rest of it. And had an agent, and I said, he was earning a lot of money then, and I could have bought one. I asked him once, nervously. It cost me £24,000. Now it'll be 20 million or something like that. But the guy that was running the Colony Room, which I drank in a lot in the evenings, everyone would go around. It was rather like being in a Western or something. It was, word would go around that Francis is turning up, he's going to be in the pub. And a lot of people thought that was great because it was free drinks. And he'd come up and he'd say, "Hello, who are you?" You know, "Oh, God. And could I swear on this?" I don't know. So Ian Board, the alcoholic who ran the pub, he had a nose, it's huge. Red thing like that. He said, "Oh, I haven't eaten for 3 days." And he drank brandy and things like that and just lived off it. He was outrageous. And he kept on introducing me, knowing that he knew that I knew that I didn't want to talk to him. And he introduced me every time. He'd say, "Francis, I want you to meet another artist." You know, he said, "Oh." Francis Baker says, "Really? What's he doing?" He said, "Artist, isn't, aren't you Mark or Amstead, they call me, very funny, Amstead Heath, get it?" So he says, "Oh, and what sort of drawings do you do?" And I was standing in front of him, backing away slowly, you know, because I knew he was going to slaughter me. And he said, "Oh, no, Cartier's very important nowadays, or any time, you know, the way people dress and look and what they say is very important in history and all that." I said, "Oh," I'm backing off. And I said, "Thank you very much, very nice." And he then turned to his friend and said, "Who was that cunt?"
And on that note, I think we normally finish, Michael, with the question about what your desert island meal would be. What would your desert island meal be? If you had to choose a last meal, what would you go for?
Oh, for God's sake. Impossible. Prunes. No, I wouldn't know. What would be my last meal? I'm very keen on sardines. Come on, we can do better than that. I guess going back to the beginning, you were told to eat up what you have. You know, "I can't eat that. I'm watching a bird on television killing a fella with a hammer." So they're told what to eat, right? So you eat whatever rubbish you were given, and you mustn't leave that plate clean, otherwise you get whacking. So I don't have anything. It could be a Mars bar. I'm very keen on scrambled eggs. The things when I was on my own a lot, I feeding myself, which is pretty dangerous. I mean, given the fact that I was drinking the amount I was drinking and working and being alone and missing, I had children, I missed them when they were taken away from me, otherwise I got upset about that. But as for eating especially, a nice piece of place I think would be nice. And I like fish, if that's of any interest to anybody, and that's about it. I'm not a eater. I was not brought up to be an eater. I know nothing. In fact, suffered, not anymore, but I've heard many years ago about not being able to know what to say to a waiter or something like that. Even in those days, could be snotty. Nowadays, they just say, "What do you want?" You don't get any, you know, that, there's not that middle class, upper middle class thing about saying the right thing, getting up the right way and talking about the right thing and eating the right thing and boring away they are. That's something I don't miss from that period. I think it's very boring.
And what would your last drink be?
I've got one here. I want a drink here. I'll have another with you tonight. I haven't got any money, but you can buy me one, you bastard. White wine, I guess. It's less. I mean, you can drink it like water, unfortunately. It does kill you, but so what? Whiskey used to be my favourite. I used to like that, but I think there's a limit to what you can do with whiskey. You know, it does terrible things to you. You could say, it allows you to say terrible things to people. You know, it's almost psychiatric. I mean, it leads people to relieve themselves from misery and unhappiness and an unhappy marriage or whatever it is. Unfortunately, you know, people start. They loosen up and saying all the truth, and you mustn't tell the truth most of the time. You mustn't even say, "Oh, marvellous." So that's it. But white wine seems to be safe to my ear.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for joining Table Talk.
Oh, thank you very much for asking me to go to Table Talk. And it was very sweet of you to ask me. and I have a nice glass of wine. Your next record is...
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.